And our special guest tonight, of course, David Pitkin. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. David, any places that ghosts tend to shy away from?
Yes, I think they either shy away from or cannot be observed where there's a lot of energy. I do a lot of speaking, a lot of storytelling, and it would be very rare to have a ghostly manifestation in a crowded room, simply because their energy is subtle. It certainly is not the dynamo that a living person would have as far as energy. And so I think those places, they would not, especially if they want to be known, they want to be recognized, which is what a lot of ghosts do. They want to let someone know they've successfully passed over. So I would think that crowded areas, no. But I think they realize that with their limited amount of energy that they can come through when a place is not crowded or not active. A lot of people tend to think, you know, the popular belief is that ghosts come out at night, but they're there all the time. It's just they can't manifest in an energy field, a big energy field. So I would say that. But the idea that ghosts cannot be in churches or holy places, I don't believe that. I have too many anecdotal records of haunted churches, whether they're active churches or not. Ghosts find a way to go there.
Well, these ghosts that, tend to show up in certain areas and shy away from others, I recall a story that a police officer called us in on once, and it said they had a call of a heart attack victim case. So they go to the house, and an old man lets them in, and they look, and they see on the floor someone lying on his stomach, face down. They turn him over. He's dead, only to realize that he was the old man who let them in.
Yep.
I mean, it's weird.
Well, there is and you understand, George, I'm still learning after 30 years. Apparently, the energy field, the thing that it sometimes can be photographed or measured, apparently it can vary in density, so that it would be entirely possible to think that this individual was living because the energy is gone from that body. It's gone to resolve his problem. That he's going to never be discovered. And very likely, I would think that when the cops turned around, the guy was gone.
Poof.
In other words, the spirit part of him was gone.
The kinds of phone calls we're going to solicit next hour, some of them I think will give you fodder for another book.
Oh, well, I've got four working now. But, there's something that's important to me. It's kind of left over from something we discussed before the break. And that is that I believe, from my experience, that over 90% of the ghost characters that I write up, over 90% of them are people kind of on the edge. I say people only because they no longer have a body. And they're looking for a resolution to their problem. They're trying to make sure that someone knows they survived. And your listeners should know that most ghosts, if you simply tell them they have died, they will go.
They will leave that quickly.
And they also will take instruction. If you tell, you have a ghost that stomps up the stairs at 3 o'clock every morning, you just go out to the stairway. You feel like a fool talking to an empty room or an empty stairway, but you just say, listen, ghost, if you want to stay here, you've got to stop this stomping at night. I need my sleep. And the vast majority of ghosts will obey. They just want to know that they are, that someone else knows they're there. And I think that helps them move on. Ultimately, this is what I've decided to do. You know, being raised in a church, being taught about the golden rule, the obligations to others. Well, my attitude now is that the golden rule doesn't stop at the grave. If you have, let's say you're driving down the freeway and you see someone broken down along the shoulder, probably on a freeway you're not going to stop. But the urge would be there, you know, to see if you couldn't help this person.
Well, you think about it at least.
Yeah, at least. And I believe that's the same with ghosts. They are just like us, except they don't have a body. They're troubled, but then who isn't? And can you help them complete their journey? Because we all have that journey to make someday. We all have to go from life in the body to call it eternal life, if you will. Who's going to help? And so my attitude is that when we go into a place, at various times I have sensitives. I have one very good friend, Susan, who's been working with me now for about 8 years. Before we leave, we do talk to the spirit and tell them it's okay. You've died, that's all, nothing serious.
Mm-hmm.
And you can move on. Can I give you a short story? It's one of my favorite.
You've got all night. Go ahead.
I've met many excellent psychics over the years. Some were in our parapsychology group. There's a woman named Gail Putnam who now lives in Florida. And Gail told me a story back in October 1983. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, she had a psychic development class in the game room in her cellar, and the people would come in, get their chairs in a circle, do their deep breathing, and prepare for one of Gail's exercises. This particular night, in Saturday night, October 83, she came down, got in her chair, everybody is about to go, and Gail looked up, and there's four soldiers walking through the cellar wall. And for a psychic, that's not much new, you know. Soldiers tonight, who knows, elephants tomorrow. And so Gail said to the leader, well, who are you soldiers, and why are you here? And the leader said, we're not soldiers, ma'am, we're Marines, and we're lost. And we saw the light that your group is giving off, and we came here. And which, that the whole idea of people meeting in groups, that's a whole other idea, too. I said to him, she says, you guys are dead. But the good news is, and for all the listeners that would like to send a ghost on their way, try this. She said to them, turn around. And behind you, you will see a brilliant white light, and go into that light, because everyone you love and everything you're looking for is there. Well, these four soldiers picked up their weapons, came to port arms, turned around, went through the other cellar wall, and they're gone. And so she did her class. 9 o'clock, she closed up. Everyone went home. Gail went to bed. The next morning, she got up, she was making breakfast, and turned on the television set on the kitchen counter, and here is all this absolute disaster footage, blinking lights and people running with stretchers and ruins and smoke, and she's reading the crawl at the bottom of the picture, and it's saying that terrorists during the night had blown up the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, Lebanon. And over 220 Marines had died instantly, they figured, in their sleep, did not know they were dead. And it didn't hit her at first. She said to her husband, gee, isn't that funny? We had four dead Marines in the cellar last night. And Jimmy said to her, well, but look here on the crawl, it says 2 a.m., Beirut time. Don't you know what that means? And she said, no, what does it mean? He said, 2 a.m. Beirut time would be 7 p.m. Eastern time. These guys are dying halfway around the world, and four of them end up here. And that will show you how quickly individuals can be out of their body and realize that the game has changed, and they're trying to orient themselves to whatever this new reality is. And I often tell this story. I actually told it once at a gathering where an elderly couple was in attendance. And the mother woman came up to me later and said that her son had been one of those boys killed in Beirut, and she'd always wondered if he made it out, you know, in spirit. But the fact that I had this story convinced her that probably they all got out and they all showed up somewhere. But they otherwise would be kind of wanderers. Now, do you want to help someone like that, some discarnate individual? My attitude is yes. What can I do to help them? Send them on their way. And maybe if I get stuck, you know, if I drop dead writing a book and I still want to finish it up, you know, maybe someone will have mercy and send me on.
You know, what's so fascinating, though, David, is just talking to you about your own personal elevation in this entire field, going from a skeptic, a non-believer, to now, you know, you're a staunch believer, and you just want the truth.
Well, yes, and I want to incorporate that reality into my behavior in this life, too. It's not just going to be a philosophical thing, but, you know, and I'm a great believer in praying for the dead. I've had a couple friends die in recent years who come to see me in my bedroom. You know, and I just tell them, thank you for coming. You know, I love you too, but you got to move on.
Why do they need to move on? If they're enjoying their existence, they're not hurting anybody. So why not let them just hang around?
Well, it's hard for me to believe that they're enjoying. I mean, so many of the ghosts reach out. They implore the living. They're trying to make contact with the living. Some of them are desperately trying to get back into a body. You know, we've talked about possession. I don't see happiness there. I find a dis-ease, an unease, because they don't fully comprehend what's happened. Stop and think about it, George. And where, other than maybe some private school where they do a course on thanatology, where does anyone prepare us how to die?
Well, they don't,
you know,
unless you pick up the old...
It's going to happen someday.
Get the old
get
book, the Egyptian Book of the Dead or something like that. But other than that, nobody really prepares us.
No. And so there's got to be a lot of confusion. And it seems strange, doesn't it? The one big thing that humanity will share, without exception. And yet we don't do any preparation for it. If you are within a certain rigid belief system or religion, you are really prohibited from going too far from the party line as to what is going to happen. And I think that's a shame. I think that dying should not be that hard. And people who get off the track a little bit, most of them can be helped to continue on.
In any of your investigating, have you come across the EVPs, the sounds of ghosts?
Yes.
Have you recorded some?
Yes. Well, that's interesting. Early last spring, I was fortunate to have three sensitives with me, including my friend Susan, and we were at a house in Fultonville, New York. It was an old Greek Revival 1835 house, and Susie, especially in one of the upstairs back bedrooms, was snapping some pictures with her phone camera. But the minute she had walked into this old room, which curiously is the only room that the owner had not restored. The owner said, "I just don't like it in there. I don't go in there at all." But she didn't know why she didn't like it. And so Susie had taken pictures, which, of course, showed some orbs moving. And just as she left the room, she heard, because Susie is clairaudient also, she heard almost like a child's voice say in her ear, "Hello." And so when we finish up a house, we sit with the owners and we say, okay, here's what we got, this room, this room, this room. And Sharon, one of the members of our group, decided to do an audio tape of this debriefing, and she had a pocket recorder with her. And so Susie told about hearing that little voice upstairs and so on. And eventually we left the house and went home, and Sharon decided to transcribe the entire tape. And as she was listening to it, Susan is talking about hearing the word hello, and in the background, twice in less than 30 seconds, a voice on the tape says, hello.
That's
and I
amazing.
Thought that was pretty evidential. It's very hard, because all of us were there. There's no way it could have been faked.
I've gotten calls from people, David, that claim that they have had calls from their dearly departed ones. And
yes.
then I say, check the caller ID. And
yes.
they say it comes up 000 or 111.
Yes.
It's really strange.
Yes, I had a delightful woman. I think perhaps she's passed over now, too. Her name was Jane Fish. Jane lived in Mound, Minnesota, and told me that when she was a college student, there was a point at which she was just totally devastated. Her father died, and, you know, she had been the apple of Dad's eye. He always called her Honey Bun. So Jane was in college. She said for the first year, her mother was so distraught that she couldn't get out of bed. And then one morning, Mom jumped out of bed and said, okay, today I'm going to make an apple pie. That was Dad's favorite pie. I'm going to make one. And she got the next door neighbor to come over. And so these two elderly women are sitting in the kitchen peeling apples. Jane, studying for college courses, is in the other room. And here's the telephone ring. She waits for the two women to answer it. No one did. So Jane went to the kitchen telephone, picked it up, and it was a man's voice. And he said, now listen here, Honey Bun.
Honey Bun?
Honey Bun. And she said, Dad! And he said, now listen, I want you to tell your mother to stop worrying. I'm okay. You're going to tell her? And Jane said, all I could do was just nod my head. And the voice said, are you going to tell her? And Jane said, yes. The phone clicked.
That's amazing.
So
it's got to be
to the mother, but she could not stand it. And she dialed the operator back and said, where did that phone call came from? You can finish this one, George.
Yeah, exactly.
there was no incoming call.
We know where it came from.
Yes. Uh-huh. But the phantom phone call is a genre of ghost story, just like the phantom hitchhiker. These stories are everywhere. Here in the East, at least, there is the story of the murdered pack peddler.
Tell us about that when we come back. Also,
sure.
I want to talk about the book Ghosts of the Northeast as well. I mean, you
yes.
still keep writing books on ghosts, don't you?
Oh, I keep cranking them out. I have about 6 files in the computer for all parts of the world.
What's your very favorite area?
Well, it still is the New England area where I live, only because of 300 and 400 years of history, you know, and the buildings here have had probably a longer time to accumulate this spirit energy. So it's nice to meet people who cohabit with perhaps a Puritan or a Pilgrim or a Native American. I like it. It's kind of romantic.
Have you gotten studies and calls about Gettysburg?
Oh, yes. Everybody's been there, you know. Or if they haven't been there, they'll listen to Coast AM and schedule the trip, you know. It's
lots of great hauntings around Gettysburg.
Yes, and of course, we're very close to the Saratoga battlefield, the big decisive battle
sure.
of the Revolution. And there's always stories coming from there, everything from lights to seeing uniformed people walking at the battle sites. I know a woman from New Hampshire who came over. She heard there were ghosts at a certain position, a place called the Balcarres Redoubt on the battlefield. There are a lot of very, very heavy casualties on both sides. And as she was walking along, a man said to her, he suddenly appeared, and he was a black man wearing not a uniform, but old-style clothing, and he said to her, I died on this spot. I want to tell you my story. And so she had a conversation with him. His problem was that he had been a slave from Connecticut. He was part of a Connecticut Minuteman regiment
yeah.
that came up to Saratoga, and he had he'd been impressed into the company because his owner didn't want to come. And I call this fellow Joshua. I don't know his name. He came up. He was despised by the members of the unit. He had only one friend. When the attack started...
Hold on. We'll be back. Indeed it is. Hey, are you a subscriber to the After Dark newsletter? Well, right now you can get 14 issues for the price of 12. So take advantage of it by calling 1-888-727-5505. This is a great, great magazine. Or go online at coasttocoastam.com. David, let's let you finish up that story before we got caught with a break there.
Sure, George. Well, this was a black man, a slave from a Connecticut farm, impressed into a Minuteman unit in March to Saratoga at the time of the Second Battle of Saratoga in October 1777. He made just one friend in the company, and then the attack was launched on the Balcarres Redoubt, and the black man said to Pam, "I saw my friend go down, and I rushed over to help him. Just then I was hit. I was shot in the back." And here I thought was a very evidential sentence. He said, "I saw my body fall on his body." You know, and who is the I that perceived this dead body fall on his friend? And then he turned to her rather pathetically, and he said, "And I think I was shot by my own men." Well, that's why he was hanging around, talking about something unfair, and he probably found himself dead, not knowing, was he dead because someone behind him was a bad shot, or because he was essentially a slave, a black man that just didn't fit in. And so he hung around that spot where he died for over 220 years until he could tell her. And then having said that, she said he just came apart into a dozen pieces, and each part just went off somewhere and he was gone. And that's the kind of thing that would keep a person hanging out, that they just want to tell somebody.
Did you see the most recent ghost movie, White Noise, with Michael Keaton?
I didn't. No.
You did not. Okay. So you can't
believe it or not. I watch very few of the TV ghost programs, and I get a chance to read very few ghost books.
Why is that?
I'm so busy. Oh, okay. I've got interviews going all the time.
So it's not,
and
it's not, not because you don't like them.
Sometimes I think some of the programs when I'm surfing channels, I'll see some of these channels that, the program is almost entirely in night vision green. And I think the story becomes too much the technology. It seems to be the same old thing over and over and over, and there doesn't often seem to be any resolution to the problem.
Why the fascination, though, David, with ghosts? I mean, it's everywhere. It's this program, you know, if I polled people, I think ghosts would come out as number one in terms of issues and stories that people like to hear.
Yes. Well, you see, it's a chance to at least mentally touch this other world. I think instinctively most people know we're going to die. This personality that I've created over many years is going to terminate. And what will be left of me? You know, what will remain? What is eternal? You know, and religions try to deal with that. So that there is a fascination that someone can be dead and yet active, if you understand what I'm saying, that life goes on. You know, there are a lot of people who say they don't believe in life after death, and I tell them that ghosts are the best proof, because ghosts are the troubled souls, the troubled personalities that are around us, and if they made it, why not the rest of us?
You know,
some people must just sail right through.
All right, one of the books I've got, Ghosts of the Northeast. Let's talk about the Northeast. Give me some stories from here.
Oh, so many. Well, these are stories from New York State, from each of the New England states, and from Canada.
The areas that seem to be haunted the most.
Well, they have the longest history. You see, the settlement went from east to west. But I have a story that just the first time I heard it, I thought this woman was putting me on. There is a nursing home up near Bar Harbor, Maine. And I talked with an RN, a registered nurse, who had worked there for over 30 years. The building originally had been an old 1800s stagecoach stop, and sometime after World War II, someone had bought it, fixed the building up, added an addition, and now it's about a 60-bed nursing home. And generally, those who come in will die there.
All right.
And her first night, of course, they put her on the night shift, her first night, in about midnight, she hears the squeaky spring on the front door. A man dressed all in black came in the front door, walked past the office and down the hall toward the elevators. And Brenda yelled at him, "Hey, mister, the sign says you got to register." And she looked up in her angled mirror, and there was no one in the hall. Huh. And she couldn't believe this. And so she jumped out of her desk, ran out into the hall. There's nobody there. Along comes one of the night nurses, a woman named Betty. And she says, "Hey, Betty, did you see that guy?" And Betty said, "No, I didn't see anybody." And she paused a minute, and she said, "Oh, wait a minute, Brenda. Was he dressed in black?" "Yeah, did you see him?" "Honey, you just seen the angel." "What?" "You just seen the angel of death. He just came to collect somebody. There's nothing, you know, nothing big." And, you know, Brenda's just can't believe, "Is this something you guys do to new hires the first night?" And she said, "And so I've been there 30 years, and we found that before any of our patients die, usually within 24 hours, this fella shows up. He's about 38 to 40 years old. He's quite handsome, dressed all in black, light brown hair. If you talk to him, he just disappears. But he always shows up, and within 24 hours, one of the patients will die." And so she told me that, and I put it down in my notes. And about 6 months later, I was doing a rough draft of that story. I just couldn't believe this. So I called her back, and I said, "Brenda, am I correct from my notes that you and Betty have seen this guy for 30 years?" And she said, "Oh, no, after I talked with you last summer, I talked with all the gals on the night shift and all the LPNs and the RNs, over 95% of them have seen this guy during the years they've worked here." And everybody is just ho-hum about it. I couldn't imagine working in a place with an alleged angel of death coming to take people away, and everybody is ho-hum. That's what gets me, where you have ghosts in workplaces, and people just, there's a mutual adjustment.
That would bother me. Yeah, that would, the Grim Reaper, I don't want around me.
Well, that's one of my favorite stories out of New England. Certainly there's great stories from Cape Cod in Massachusetts. An old ship captain's house at Eastham, right on what they call the Elbow. And friends bought it, husband and wife. He's an industrialist, not what you'd call a true believer by any means, but he had all kinds of noises in the house. Things would be moved. But anyway, when they bought the place, they were still living in Rochester, New York. So the first summer, they rented it out to a dive crew. Now, I can't remember the fella's name, but he's quite famous. He found on what's called Marconi Beach, just off the shore, he found a ship called the Whydah. And the Whydah was a known slave ship that was captured by pirates and run by a fella named Black Sam Bellamy, the pirate leader, who took a lot of ships, a lot of treasure in the 1700s, and worked the New England coast. Allegedly, he had buried his treasure somewhere. And then on his southern trip, a hurricane came along and destroyed the ship, killing Bellamy and almost all the crew. So this dive crew had found the frame of the old ship on the offshore, and here they are staying in Mike's house all that summer. And, of course, they had a number of sea captain ghost experiences. But here's what I found curious, that Paul and Paula, Mike and Paula, bought another house way up the New England coast, up at a place called Starboard, Maine, which was another ship captain's house. And when they got to know the history of the area, allegedly it was in the front yard of Captain Proctor's house in Starboard that Sam Bellamy had buried his treasure. Although there was a lot of excavation, apparently no one found it. But to have two homes over 300 miles apart, both linking the same pirate, I thought, that's fascinating. And Mike and Paula had no big experiences, but whoever they rented their houses out to, these people would have all kinds of sightings and moved objects and sounds and so on. And that's New England ghost stories at the very best. I also turned up a number of just scanning old newspapers from the 1800s. You find fascinating stories. Another one from Machias Port, Maine, very near Starboard.
Which is the case, David, in any of them that you've looked at, investigated, which is the saddest one for you?
Wow. Well, that's a good one. I would have to say where, and there are a number of stories, where the individual did not accomplish what they wanted to accomplish. And I keep trying to think up of a specific one right now, and it's not coming up on my screen. But it's sad to have children die young and then be around begging for recognition. They don't know what's happened to them. I've run into a lot of children ghost stories. I would say to me those are the saddest, because it appears that this individual did not get to live a full life.
No, that's true. And I'll tell you the ones that for me are the chilling stories and the sad ones. Yeah. When I hear EVPs of children,
yes,
or ghost stories of children, those to me are very sad.
Yes, because there's some, if you're getting a voice, I mean, go ahead, explain it to me. I'm a physics dropout, but I don't understand. If you have a voice, don't you still have a personality of some kind? And so this once upon a time child is still not at rest. And I feel sad about that. These are the ghosts that I like to talk to and just tell them, hey, you're dead. It's okay. There's something better waiting for you. Just move on.
Where can people get your books?
Well, New York State Ghosts is my new one. That's available in every bookstore in New York State, whether it's Barnes & Noble, Borders, Walden Books. Most of the independent bookstores have it. Ghosts of the Northeast is available at just about every bookstore in New York State and New England. I do have another one. I have two titles about Saratoga County, which is where I first started. Those are pretty much available in the Capital District area of New York State. But of course, Amazon.com is where everybody goes to get a copy of the book. The New York State Ghost, I started with 150 stories, and I'm self-published, George. All my
are
books.
You really? I didn't know that.
Yep. And that's, you want to talk about scary. when I did my Ghosts of the Northeast, I had to print, to get the per book cost down, I had to print 30,000 books. Do you know what 30,000 books looks like? It filled up the whole garage.
That's huge. That's right.
And of course, just in the amount of money I had to borrow to print them. And we've sold over 2/3 of them. So
good for
we're
you.
Up around 22,000.
Good for
that.
You. And how are you doing it? Just word of mouth, doing radio shows, things
well,
like that?
Well, I certainly do a lot of talk shows, a lot of, I have a very strong reader base here in eastern New York and in New England.
Well, you're on nearly 500 stations right now.
Yes, I understand. This is the Carnegie Hall. I told my friend this morning, this is the Carnegie Hall of talk radio, and I'm very honored that you have me on.
Well, you've done a great job. Tell me about the picture on the cover of New York State Ghosts.
Oh, that's a nice one. That's a story from the house. Is located in the northern part of my town. I live in Chestertown, New York. And in the northern part of the town of Chester, there is a rather famous little community called North Creek. And about a year and a half ago, I was doing some storytelling for a local historical society, and this delightful elderly woman named Clara West let it be known that she might be willing to share the story of her house. And I think that's the third story in the book. But her house was so photogenic, that I just had to use it. The photo rendition that's on the cover is a 1910 photograph. Now, that house replaced a house that had been there before. Clara's father, when he was a little boy, he used to walk by the previous house and saw a woman dressed all in black leaning against a pear tree in the yard, but he knew that no old woman lived there. And he discovered that that previous house, a man had married a woman, promising to take care of her and her mother. But then somewhere along the way, this fella decided, well, but he didn't have to live with the mother, and he fixed up a chicken coop out in the yard and put a wood stove in there. And but then one winter night, and we have some pretty cold winters here in the Adirondacks, the guy forgot to fill the stove. The old lady froze to death, and apparently is one of the ghosts still on the property. She stayed around, even though that old house was torn down and the house that's on the cover was built about 1911. It's a very nice old Queen Anne-style house. And so Clara said to me, and I think she just turned 90, so she would have been born in 1916.
Good for her.
She said, well, the ghost was here when I was born. And the ghost is rather friendly. He spends a lot of, there's one that's definitely male, stomping up and down the stairs at night and leaving windows open. And then she thinks that the old woman is the one that kind of sneaks up behind her when she's doing the dishes. But she's absolutely just unfazed by the whole thing. She said that the ghost was here when I was born. Ghost was here when my kids were born. They grew up with it. Now my grandkids come.
Sounds like she doesn't bother her, huh?
It doesn't bother her a bit. You know, said she was watching television the other night with her grandson. And the stomping started on the stairs, and the grandson said, who do you think that is, Grandma? She says, I sure don't know. Now be quiet. You're bothering my program.
Do you ever see the day where science is going to be able to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that this all is real?
Well, the energy field should be the first thing that they're able to isolate. Certainly the energy is there. And whether we'll be able to identify, well, that's somewhere off in the future. You know, will there be some kind of a electronic DNA that people can use to identify without question who this is that's still hanging out?
Well, and if it is energy, too, wouldn't it be incredible if they developed some kind of a camera-type device and you take a picture, and all of a sudden you see these entities and these beings all over the place?
Well, if you talk with gifted psychics, that camera exists as a human person.
In their head.
Yeah, well, in some area of their consciousness, they see, or many see and hear, and to be around some of these gifted people is just amazing. And I've kept my skepticism throughout all of this. I think because someone tells me this or that is going on, I don't necessarily believe. But it sure is a marvelous thing to go out with a good psychic. Whenever I go out with Susie, she continually amazes me because she will sit down and meditate the day before we go out on a trip. I never tell her where we're going or anything about the place. I prefer not to know much about these places we go to. And she'll sit down and meditate. A year ago, we went to a Methodist Church parsonage, and just a super pastor there. He had had experiences, and he wanted us to find out what else was there. And when I pulled up in front of the place, Susie's looking all over the place. And I said, what's the matter? She said, I can't find the cemetery. And she said, there's supposed to be a cemetery here. I saw it yesterday. And then she found it. It was across the street. And people like this amaze me. And she's not looking to be a television personality or anything. She just likes old houses. She likes the mystery.
All right. Well, stay with us because we're going to take phone calls next with David Pitkin. If you want to share your ghost story or perhaps you just have a question or two. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.